previously on We Live Here.
We were going to have a flourishing community, and of course the bottom dropped out, and we've not been able to get up there since.
And the thing that gets me is that we were here before a lot of these folks. A lot of the folks that sit in the city councils, that sit on boards, that even built these new homes. We've been here for over 200 years.
You know, if you don't know where you've been, it's hard to predict where you're going to end up. And you need to know your past in order to kind of work with the future for the future. And the more we know, black and white, know about the history of an area or community, the better prepared to deal with the day.
Hey guys, it's me, Camille.
And me, Tim. And it's time now for like one of our favorite things we get to do, which is our annual storytelling event, I Live Here.
I Live Here. We had it just a couple weeks ago here in St. Louis, and we had a bunch of awesome locals come tell stories on stage about home and the stories that they hold.
So let's get out of the way and let's get to the show. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is I Live Here.
For We Live Here.
A show and a podcast.
And a storytelling event.
Yeah, for people somewhere on the woke spectrum.
Our first story comes from Shafante Ross.
So, when I was little, we moved a lot. We moved a whole lot. I was doing something at work recently where we were tracking, you know, we were creating a form around family experiences and the strengths of families and how we can track, you know, things that go on in their lives that can hinder some of that strength. And that is how often children move, you know, especially before certain ages. And when the form came to me, when we were, you know, in this editorial meeting, I started thinking about, and I passed it along, I started thinking about like how many times I've moved, you know, when I was in K through 12. That's limited to that. And when I wrote down all of my addresses, because elephant memory, I'd moved in between kindergarten and 12th grade. I'd moved around St. Louis 21 times. That's a lot. That's a whole lot. My mom and father, stepfather, worked low-wage jobs all of my life. My mother supported us with my stepfather working full-time at Taco Bell from my seventh grade year through high school. She worked very hard. My stepfather worked very hard and just ends just didn't meet. Something always did not get paid, but we always got fed. And so anyway, I remember as a kid, as a very young child, loving television. And I loved, I don't know how many of you remember this. If you are a millennial or an older millennial, you probably remember TGIF. Yes, TGIF, it was awesome, right? So I loved TV. And one of the things that I noticed about TV or sitcoms especially, I couldn't pinpoint it at that time, but TV characters never moved. They never moved. They were always in that living room or in the kitchen or like whatever the set was on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, on Family Matters, on whatever. It was just like two locations. There was so much, you know, stability with the families on TV. And when the families did move, it was a big thing. It was a big episode. And it was always sad to me. And I didn't know that as a kid, but I loved that they never moved. Like I knew what was gonna be, what was Judy gonna do on this episode. And one of the shows that I loved as a little kid was Full House. Now you guys remember Full House? I did not grow up in Full House. I grew up in 21 apartments around St. Louis. So this part of my home story is how delusional I was. As when I watched Full House, every TGIF, I loved Full House so much. It wasn't even in syndication yet, y'all. I'm old. So I was watching it in real time. And so I used to watch it and I used to love how much freedom the kids had. They were expressing their feelings. They were, you know, like it was just great. And so I can remember, you know, Danny Tanner and Uncle Joey and, you know, Uncle Jesse and all that, they would always be asking the kids, how are you feeling? I don't remember that from my life. And so I can remember, I can remember, and please don't laugh at me. Well, you can laugh, but just know that I don't believe this today. There came a time where when I would get into trouble, which wasn't very often, but again, stressed out parents, it happens, right? So I would get into trouble, or my mom would ask me to do something, and I didn't want to do it because, you know, eight. I would go to my room, and y'all, I would wait for the dramatic sitcom music to come on, where, you know, where it signified that, like, something's wrong. Like, you know what I mean? Ooh, Stephanie got a D, how's she gonna explain it? Like, that, I would sit on the edge of my bed, and I would wait for that music to come on, and then what happens after the music comes on? Parent comes in, you know, we gotta talk about this, Deej. You know what I mean? Like, that was what I would wait. I would sit there and wait. Y'all, one day I did it with my mother. Like, she said something to me, and I was like, you know, whatever. So I go to my room, and I'm sitting on the end of my twin bed or whatever. I'm kicking stuff around or whatever, and I'm just waiting for the music. Like, I literally was waiting for the music. Again, I don't think this today, and I didn't think it for much longer after that, but I was waiting for the music. And my mama never came in, y'all. Like, she never came in. So I get over it. I probably, like, fell asleep or something. But then it happened. I will never forget this. It happened one day when my friends came over. And now, the people who attend regularly Second Tuesdays, you know how much I loved my friends as a kid. I loved my friends. Like, friends and snacks. It was everything. So anyway, I was with my friends. We were in the living room. And I have a little sister. She's 5 years younger. When you're 10... ugh, you know what I mean? When you're 10 and she's 5, it's just like, she's just like, oh my gosh, you're amazing. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you're not. So we're hanging out in the living room. We got all My Little Pony stuff, you know, like in the living room. And like, it's a complete hazard. And my mom is, you know, my sister's trying to hang out, and I'm like, no, my friends are over. Like, we acting fast. We got the doll heads. We're playing Salon. And so anyway, my mom comes trudging through the living room. She was like, get this stuff up, get it up. And I was just like, whatever, my girls are here. So she trudges through again, and she's like, what did I say? Get this stuff up. And so I'm scooting it over, but I'm not getting it up because this is my house, you know. So anyway, I don't get it up. She comes through, and she bends over near me, and she was like, you got one more time to not get this stuff up like I told you to do. And so I scoop it up. She starts walking out, and I start huffing, and I'm scooping it. You know, or whatever. Not too loud. You know, I ain't stupid. You know, like, I don't want my headstone to read 1984 to 1994. So, you know, I'm not dumb. So, but loud enough so that my friends are impressed. Loud enough so that, you know, they like, oh, she fancy. She don't get whoopings, you know. So, anyway, so I go up the steps. I'm not stomping because, again, I'm not stupid. So, I get to my room. And I sit there on the edge of my bed, that twin bed. We were on Gibson, y'all. They're like, this is how, we're on Gibson. And this time she comes in. No music, because I stopped expecting that. But she comes in, and I'm just like, yes. You know? And she says, I don't know what's getting into you. You're showing out in front of your little friends. But don't get your head knocked off. I don't remember this episode. So I'm just like, oh, okay. Well, never the mind. I did not have a super hard childhood, but you know, we went through some things, and we went through some things as a family. And I love my mother and my stepfather. I will always envy the freedom that Stephanie, DJ, and Michelle had. But I did not grow up in the Full House house. I grew up in 21 apartments around St. Louis. My mother is not Danny Tanner. She is Kathy Ivey. Thank you.
We'll get back to more great stories from right here in St. Louis from community members talking about home after this break.
So my name is Stephen Holsworth, and when I was born, my grandfather was a very active and feisty 76-year-old named Clarence Percy Barker. He grew up in a little town called Enfield, Maine. His grandfather was my namesake, Dr. Stephen Hurd, who was the only doctor in Enfield, Maine for over 50 years. And Dr. Stephen Hurd's grandfather was Jonathan Hurd, who was given a plot of land after the Revolutionary War next to Coldstream Pond in what became Enfield, Maine. And he built a farmhouse on it that my grandfather's grandfather, Dr. Stephen Hurd, added a little office to, and that my grandfather grew up in before he left at the age of 20. That farm was run by his sister, my great aunt Lottie, after his father and mother died. And that's how I found myself in the summer of 1970, getting out of a car in Enfield, Maine, and walking up to the general store, gas station, post office, it might have served a few other purposes, police station in Enfield, that along with the Grange and the church made up the downtown of the 800-person town of Enfield, Maine. And I went into that little store with my mother. And Pearl, I didn't know her name then, but I found it out eventually. Pearl said to my mother, "Oh, Ginny, it's so sad about Lottie." And then she looked at me, and I found out who I was in Enfield, Maine. And she said to me, she was the first one to say it to me, of hundreds of people who would say it to me that week, "You must be Percy's grandson." And that's how I found out who I was in Enfield, Maine. I was Percy's grandson. So we got a few things. Penny candy in that store was actually a penny then, still. We got some penny candy. We got a few things because my mother wasn't sure what the state of the house was going to be. And off we went to the farm. Now, Enfield, Maine was a place I'd never been to before that day. But it lived in my imagination because my grandfather lived with us. And my parents were very, very wonderful people. And they were rule followers. They liked rules. My grandfather, Percy, Grampy didn't like the rules so much. And when you were 4, 5, or 6, Grampy was a lot more fun. Grampy liked to smoke cigars and drink whiskey, and take me on adventures, which my mother and father really did not appreciate. And on these adventures, it was also combined with a story about Enfield, a story about his stern grandfather, the doctor, who didn't like how he got up to mischief even when he was younger, of stories of the Coldstream Pond, of swimming there, and stories of drag racing down the one road when they first got a car. And all of these stories made Enfield to me this place of imagination that lived inside me. It felt like I knew Enfield, even though I'd never been there. But what I found out that summer when we went to bury my great aunt Lottie, and it was the first time that I had made it to Enfield, what I found out was not only did Enfield live in my imagination, I lived in Enfield's imagination. Because literally hundreds of people that week said to me, "Oh, you're Percy's grandson. You must be Percy's grandson. You're Percy's grandson. You know how we're related? Your grandfather is my second cousin. You must be Percy's grandson. You know, my uncle used to work for Dr. Hurd way back when. You must be Percy's grandson. Percy got my daughter in so much trouble when they were little." And that was by like an ancient guy who was like 97 or something. Because my grandfather is 80 by this point. So like the people who are talking about him as a kid are like, I had never seen people of this age before. But then even the younger ones, I was like, how do they know about that I'm Percy? Like people my parents' age, like, oh, well, Ginny used to come up because my mother went to Enfield as a girl. And I heard about Roger Whittaker, her beau, before she met my father. And he was there in Enfield, Maine, and I met Roger Whittaker's kids. And they were like, oh, they were the only ones. You're Ginny's son. They were the only ones. I gotta tell you, the only, everybody else, I was Percy's grandson. So when we think about home and we think about how we make home, sometimes home is a place, a house, a physical location that we have some association with. Sometimes home is the people that we've built a community with. We have memories of them. We have connections with them that are in our lives, in our walk through life, that we've walked together. Sometimes it's communities of people that we've spent time in. Sometimes it's communities of faith. Sometimes it's communities of activism. Sometimes it's communities of music or art or dance or something. But this was a place that I'd never been to. This was a place that was still home. I had come home to a place I'd never been. And staying in that house that my grandfather's grandfather's grandfather built, and sleeping in the bedroom that my namesake, Dr. Stephen Hurd, had built as his office, I looked around and there were mementos. There was his diploma. There was medical equipment. The room hadn't changed in 100 years since he had been a doctor there. And I wanted it. I wanted it all. I grew up in the big city. We lived in a city of 150,000 people. Enfield had 800 at that time. I wanted to be in that place where everybody knew me. I wanted to be in that place where nothing changed. I wanted to take it all home with me. Because you see, when Aunt Lottie died, nobody wanted the pig farm anymore. There was no close relative. She had no children. We were the closest family. Grampy Barker had left the pig farm a long, long time ago. He was not meant for a pig. He could not have sustained being a pig farmer. And he had left. And my mother had, even though she had her fun summers up in Enfield, my mother had grown up in the city and was not going to go to a farm. And I was too young, luckily, because who knows, I might have been a pig farmer in Maine right now. But I was too young to say, I want this farm. And so the farm was leaving. Now, it was going to leave to someone we knew, most probably, because we knew everybody in Enfield. It seemed, at least, everybody knew Percy. But it was leaving. And so my mother let me take one thing, and I took that diploma with the name of my namesake on it to have with me when I got back home, to remind me that there was a place that I went to for the first time. And when I got there, everybody knew me. And I was home to a place I'd never been before. Thank you.
Our final story comes from Mariah Richardson.
When I think of home, I think of a place where there's love overflowing. I wish I was home. I wish I was back there with the things I've been knowing. You might recognize that song from The Wiz. And that song is in a special place in my heart because I'm always wishing for home. Because it's the American dream. A little house with a picket fence and a yard, big enough to grow flowers, maybe a tomato or two, but big enough to mow, because I love to mow grass. I love ripping the cord. I love getting out the little edger, like I'm just lining it up like my haircut. I'm like, it's all fresh. I mow and I think of nothing else, just the grass, the sun, and me. So the American dream of owning one's own house, a place to build a foundation, a place to create family and home, a place of solace and sanctuary. But that dream has eluded me. You know that there are restrictions on where you can live, right? Certain areas that are denied you, certain areas that are forced on you. Redlining. If you were to look at maps that lending institutions have, you could see them. Red lines are where black people can only buy. The Del Mar Divide is named such because of St. Louis's racial divisions in housing. So after having spent most of my youth in public housing, CODE, the projects, my mother was able to buy a house, and she was so proud of her accomplishment, and I was too. Because my mother had come up in the Depression. Her family had migrated from Mississippi. She had finished high school and gotten an LPN license, and she had raised two children, one which had disabilities. So I was just so happy for her that she had been able to do this. But she bought this house when I was a senior in high school, so I only lived in the house really for about 5 months before I went off to college. The house was only a few blocks from O'Fallon Park, and when my mother was younger, she had to be out of that park before sundown because St. Louis is a sundown town, right? So my mother bought this house. And it turns out she bought the house for me. But like I said, I was in my last semester of high school, and she had figured that if she bought this house, I would stay here because she's a Leo, and you know, Leos don't never want their kids to leave. They like hold on to them for dear life, and I was just like, no, because she had taught me to be independent. I'm like, I'm up. I got to go. So I went to the University of New Mexico. And so I've lived in many places. I've lived in New Mexico, I've lived in California, Illinois, Massachusetts. So after I finished graduate school in Massachusetts, I moved back to Los Angeles because, you know, I was this actor and I was about to do that thing. And Hollywood, I was gonna blow it up and I was gonna be rich and famous. Yeah, that's what I was going to do. So I went back to LA and I was more mature, I was more centered in myself and like, yeah, I'm about to take this over. And so I came back to St. Louis for a visit and I got to my mother's house. It was a mess, like a tornado had hit the house. And it's just her and my disabled brother that are living in this house. And my mother was not this woman, this vibrant woman that I remember. She was this little old lady. So I came back to St. Louis and left my dreams of Hollywood and moved back. But my mother had become a woman that age had changed. And no longer did she cook my favorite foods because she would forget an ingredient or, you know, she just wasn't able to do it the same way. This one time, she made spaghetti, and she used a jar of paste picante sauce as spaghetti sauce. And I yelled at her. And I yelled at her because I was angry about her growing old. I wasn't used to it, and so it took me a trip to Europe to figure out what she must be going through because I had no idea what it felt like to be in my 80s. So she would leave water running and overflowing sinks in the bathroom. She left a pot boiling and burned the pot. Her mail was all over the house and bills weren't getting paid. So I move back and I move in. Home. It was my mother's house. It was where my mother and my disabled brother lived. It was their home. But I was worried about them. So after I got back, a few months after being, I moved into the house with them. And after being back a few months, my brother has a stroke. And we send him to rehab. And I can't wait for him to rehab so I can bring him back home. Now, he's living on the second floor because my mother had moved herself to the first floor, and she had a little twin bed in the dining room. And so now he's back, and I move him from the second floor, and I put him in the dining room with her. And then each morning between 2 and 3 a.m., I have to get up and walk him to the bathroom so that I don't have to change linens the next morning. And when he fell, it was so hard because I couldn't just pick him up. So the doctor suggested that we let him live in the nursing home. And this was no longer his home. And it broke my heart. After he left and went to the nursing home, I decided that, you know, I'm a grown woman. I do grown woman things. It's time for me to have my own place. So I move out, I get a little apartment, and I just go check on my mother, make sure everything's okay. And after 2 years of being in an apartment, it occurred to me, this woman has a four-bedroom house that's paid for. Why are you paying rent to somebody else? So I decide to move back in. But remember, my mother has not been up in her upstairs on the second floor in years. And it's a mess. I got a ceiling falling down in the TV room. I got walls, plaster walls that are falling in. And it's just a wreck up there. But I decide I'm just going to fix this place up. And so I put her house in a reverse mortgage. I replace her furnace. I redo both bathrooms. I repair the ceiling and the electricity in the TV room. I put a deck on her back, on her where her porch used to be. I give her a nice deck, which she did not sit on, because she was just like, I'm not trying to sit out there. Okay, so I'm sitting out there, and I do all of this work, and now I got a nice little crib upstairs on the second floor. It's nice. I got my bedroom to turn the TV room into my office space. I got a meditation room. I got an extra bedroom for guests if anybody comes over. So I feel like I'm kind of making home. But I know that after my mother passes, that whenever that happens, that I'm going to move back to Los Angeles because I got to keep going. I mean, I am an artist, and so I got to get back. So it was hot in July in 2012. Actually, it was July 11th, which is tomorrow, would be an anniversary. And I had been back in St. Louis for 10 years. And it was a typical 103-degree heat index day, right? Hotter than hell. But we're supposed to go to see my brother, because every Saturday we go see my brother and we play bingo. But it's hot, and it's so hot. And I'm like, Mama, are you sure you want to go? I'm going to see my firstborn. All right, girly. I got you. We're going to go. But I noticed she hadn't been eating very much, and I was thinking that it may be the heat that was keeping her from having an appetite. So we go, we see my brother, we play bingo, he wins, it's fun, and we come back home. And I start to notice little things. I noticed that my lucky bamboo that sat in my window in my bedroom, which was right above her bed on the first floor, the leaves started to suddenly fall off. and the cat, Shane, who we had gotten from the Humane Society, because they do this thing where they have older cats and they put them with older adults and it doesn't cost you very much to get the cat, and they fell in love with each other, so Shane wouldn't leave her side. So I'm just watching, and I know something's up, but I'm not sure what's going on. So that Wednesday morning, I get up to get dressed to go to work, and I come downstairs, and she's still in bed. She looks at me. She smiles. She waves at me like little kids who are learning how to wave. And I'm like, you ain't up. You okay? She's like, yeah. So she gets up. She washes up. She dresses herself. And she's taken a long time to walk from the bathroom through the dining room to the living room to her favorite spot on the couch. It's like, you're moving kind of slow. You okay? Yeah, I'm fine. So I go in the kitchen and I get her coffee. And I come back and she's toppled over onto the coffee table. She's unconscious. So I immediately hit the 911 button on the alarm pad. And I get her comfortable. She's still out, and I'm holding her hand, and I'm telling her, me and Keith are going to be okay. I love you. I'm going to be okay. And I'm hearing these words, and I'm not understanding why I'm speaking these words. And the ambulance comes, and they say, okay, we got to take her to the hospital, and they ask me, do I want to ride with them? I'm like, no, I'll just drive, because I'm sure that once we get to the hospital, they'll give me the diagnosis of what old age thing is making her fall out today. And I'll go to work and I'll come back and visit her later on in the day. So when I get to the hospital, and I go to this room and there's a nurse in the room, and we're just kind of chilling, just waiting to hear. And the nurse says, you know, it's taken them a long time to come and tell us what's going on. So let me go back there and see what's going on. And then she comes back a few minutes later with the doctor, and he says, I'm sorry. We did everything that we could. 45 minutes from the time she collapsed till she was no longer in this world. I walked around her house, and now it was my house and the bank's. But you can't trust the bank, because the bank had lied and said that I would be able to negotiate this. They wouldn't even let me get an appraisal for the house. So I gave the house back to the bank, because I wasn't going to stay here anyway, because I was going back to Los Angeles. And I went back to Los Angeles. Those were the darkest days that year. The darkest. I had no idea how much I was going to miss my mother. I had no idea, because nobody can prepare you for that. Nobody. And then I went up to Portland, Oregon, because I have a half-brother up there, and spent a year. And then found out there was a temporary job, so I came back to St. Louis. But my brother is here by himself, really, so it was good. And he had missed me, and I needed to be with him because he needed his family, and I am his family. Ever since I gave that house back to the bank, I'm always looking at houses. I look at houses every day. In Portland, I had a realtor. I'm on Trulia, realtor.com. I got 3 agents here, no joke. 3 agents. Because I'm so wanting to own my own house, to make a home. I am so desperate for home. Thank you.
Next time on We Live Here.
These are nice houses.
I wouldn't promote nothing that's not nice. These are nice houses, and I really missed out on. They really overlooked. They're nice, though. I promise you that it's gonna come up. And that's my word of the end that I'm doing. It's gonna come up.
Because he gets the word out to all levels of people, from couples, retired couples, young people, et cetera. He gets the word out that this is doable. You can own your own home.
We want to make sure that once again, we give a very, very special thank you to all of our storytellers. They were great.
In fact, there's a couple storytellers that you guys haven't heard yet. So if you go to our website, welivehere.show, we'll put up the raw audio of the entire event to get you some more listening in.
We also want to give a very special shout out and thank you to Second Tuesdays. They're a local storytelling group in St. Louis, and they helped us organize this event.
And last but certainly not least, we need to give a very special shout out to Trifecta. You guys don't know this, but Trifecta makes a lot of the music that we use on our show. And for this episode, we kind of handed over things to him, and he did the music and the mixing.
We Live Here is produced by me, Tim Lloyd.
And me, Camille Stanley.
Alana Sistrunk is our associate producer.
And Robert Peterson is our boss. He's the director of programming here at St. Louis Public Radio.
And from St. Louis Public Radio on PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.